Lots of brave women have been coming forward to speak up about sexual harassment. But how do those claims hold up in our court system? Employment law scholar Suja Thomas explains why she thinks federal judges aren't properly enforcing existing discrimination laws. And the true crime podcast Suspect Convictions shines a light on a 1998 Bloomington murder and asks, did the police really get their man?
From day one, Barton said, I didn't do this. Somebody broke into the house and suffocated my daughter, and I think it was my girlfriend who I broke up with yesterday because she has a history of violence. I think this is the person who did this.
Attorney General Lisa Madigan joins us to talk about her settlement and lawsuit against the now-dissolved charity VietNow. And Illinois sports fans, we're finally going to give you a team to cheer for. Let's hear it for the Whitney Young High School Dolphins. The Lady State Tennis Champs joins us. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. The latest news is next. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The problem of sexual harassment and how pervasive it is within the American workplace has been a national story for weeks now. Why it's so pervasive is a big question. People often point to overwhelming cultural norms or, when it comes to discrimination, unconscious bias. But there's another reason that problems persist. University of Illinois employment law scholar Suja Thomas thinks that part of the problem lies with our court system and specifically with federal judges. She writes that judges are likely to dismiss cases of sexual harassment or discrimination when they go to court, in spite of laws like the Civil Rights Act or other broad federal legislation that should provide protection. Why discrimination cases in general have such a hard time being won through our legal system is also the topic of her latest book that she co-authored along with Sandra Sperino. It's called Unequal, How America's Courts Undermine Discrimination Law. Suja Thomas joins us now from our Urbana studios. Suja, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
Suja, I should say, I should warn our audience that I'm going to explain in some rather graphic language some claims that you said were dismissed. And I think it's important to mention them. Because they seem so egregious when we're talking about sexual harassment. You write about cases where coworkers and supervisors made comments about a woman's breasts, requesting her to lick whipped cream off of them. Other workers, a supervisor asking a female worker to go to a hotel room and spend the night with him. Lots of other things that actually get worse than that. And they all, these sound horrible, and at face value, they sound like classic harassment. How are cases like this getting dismissed by judges?
Yes, there are a number of different procedures, as well as what courts call doctrines and inferences that courts use to dismiss cases. There's a procedure called summary judgment that's used before trial. And a judge can decide that he or she thinks that a reasonable jury could not find for the person bringing the case. And so oftentimes that's the procedure that's used. And what a court will do is they'll say, here are some facts from a hostile environment case. That's what they'll call a sexual harassment case. And they'll say, this is not, let's say, for example, they'll say, this is not severe or pervasive enough to actually alter the working conditions of this employee to create a hostile or abusive working environment. And so as a result, we're going to dismiss this case. And this is despite the fact that, as you said, the facts of the case are very sort of bad facts, bad explicitly, things that we have, all of us would never want to have happen to us. And despite the fact that there is really broad language in the statute that provides that someone is not supposed to be discriminated against because of their sex.
And so according to one study, you write about this, there's one study from 2007 that says when employers request dismissal of discrimination claims, which include harassment claims, more than 70% are dismissed in whole or in part. Do you think that's also where is the problem here? Because you talk about federal judges, this is before cases are even going to juries, or there are times even we write about when judges dismiss juries verdicts.
Right. And so these doctrines and inferences are being used by judges to dismiss these cases. And so this Federal Judicial Center study that you mentioned from 2007 studied about six, I think, district courts, and found that all of these cases are being dismissed at a very, very high rate. And you even see some areas of the country, like Atlanta, where the dismissal rate is even higher. And so they use these made-up doctrines and inferences to say, well, we think now that what you and I would think is a factual question is a legal question. So in the example I gave before, the severe pervasive requirement, they'll say, this is a legal question, and I get to decide whether these facts are severe or pervasive enough. And if they're not, then I'm going to dismiss the case. Or they might say a comment that's discriminatory, let's say calling someone the N-word, which unfortunately happens in many workplaces still. Someone calling someone the N-word in January, but then making a decision not to promote them in July, they'll call it a stray remark, was made in January. It doesn't mean there was discrimination in not giving that promotion in July. So all of these, we found about 20 different ways that courts are really destroying, we think, the discrimination law.
I'm speaking with employment law scholar Suja Thomas. She teaches law at the University of Illinois. She's also the co-author of a new book. It's called Unequal: How America's Courts Undermine Discrimination Law. Suja, I think to understand some of this, because I think there's sort of the, I think there's the legal world, which operates in a way that, frankly, those of us who are not lawyers don't really understand, because it seems illogical, right? So I wonder if you can just explain a little bit of the role that federal judges play in determining whether or not cases go to a jury trial, or what's the role? Can you explain that process?
Sure. At the beginning of a case, you file a case in court, and at that point in time, after you file your complaint, a judge can actually decide at that point in time that he or she thinks that the claim is not plausible. And if the judge thinks the claim is not plausible, the court can actually dismiss the case, and the case does not go to a jury trial. That is generally not happening. It doesn't happen usually that early in the case. But then after what's called discovery, and that is each side gives information to the other side, you might have a deposition, that is information given, basically an interview by a lawyer of another party. After information is gathered between the parties, documents, depositions, that someone will make a motion for summary judgment and say, I don't think a reasonable jury could find for the person who's brought this case, and as a result, judge, you should dismiss this case. The statistic that you mentioned earlier is the statistic that's the dismissal rate on summary judgment in many places. And then even after a case goes to trial and a jury finds for one party, let's say the plaintiff, then even then the judge can say, I don't think a reasonable jury could have found for the plaintiff. The jury was unreasonable. I'm going to order the case for the employer. So there are all these different points in time. And then even then, if the plaintiff wins before the jury, and then the judge thinks that it's fine, the employer can then appeal. And even at that point in time, the appellate court can reverse. And if you can believe this, where the jury found for the plaintiff, the case went to the appellate court, and the trial court thought it was fine, the appellate court will reverse over 40% of the time.
That's remarkable. I mean, if we think about that, this is a simple question. I know it's not an easy answer. You alluded to some of this, why this is happening with this whole idea of these sort of judge-made rules. How is all of this happening? It doesn't seem like this is how the legal process is supposed to work.
Why is a difficult question to answer? One of the things that I will say is that, you know, the jury is obviously a very different body than one particular judge or even two or three judges. One, if you look at the federal system, federal judges are chosen by the president of the United States. They're some of the most have some of the most elite backgrounds in the country. That is different than a person on a jury, for the most part, who has experienced life and oftentimes in a very different way. And that's very valuable, I think, to judge what's happening in workplaces across the country. So that's one factor. Another factor is simply that you have federal judges are more male than female. So the percentage of federal judges who are active, who are male, are 65. It's 65% of federal judges versus 35% female. That obviously doesn't track the general population. So you're having actually more males than females deciding these cases. Political party is something you could try to mention, but you actually see judges of both political parties deciding cases against plaintiffs. And so that's not an easy answer to the question. You don't have deliberation when you don't have a jury. So those are some of, I think, the factors that are coming into play here.
You write in your book that it's time for courts to understand that there's a new politics of discrimination law. And I wonder if you think that now that we're having such a national conversation in the past few weeks regarding sexual harassment, but I'm thinking about the past year or two in terms of discrimination and everyone being much more familiar with things like microaggressions and terms like that. Do you think that the national conversation may change the culture around federal judges who, you know, by all of these examples, who are literally not really following the federal laws as they're just as the Civil Rights Act or as Title VII and all of these other laws that are supposed to protect against discrimination are written?
I wish that would be the case, but I don't think that's going to happen. I don't think that by being exposed to the fact that there is, in fact, sexual harassment in the workplace and people like Harvey Weinstein and other people at higher positions are actually engaging in that type of activity, because they see these individual cases and they think that sometimes the district courts will think that because of what the appellate court said, that they have to say that their case doesn't constitute discrimination because their case is not worse or the same as this case that was dismissed by the appellate court. You know, there's this case that someone sent to me recently as an example where the plaintiff testified he saw displays of the rebel flag on toolboxes and hard hats, the letter KKK on the bathroom wall, a block saw console, a noose in another employee's locker. Another supervisor told him if he looked at that white girl, he would cut him. And another supervisor called him black boy on one occasion. That an appellate court dismissed that case as not having enough evidence of discrimination of racial harassment. And then a district court said, well, I have to dismiss my case as well because my case does not meet that standard. Almost no case is going to meet that standard. And so we have case after case where these judges who I think really don't have a good concept of what harassment should be defined as deciding these cases.
And I guess the question is how can that change? I mean, especially as you're talking about the backgrounds of these judges. I mean, at one point, I feel like I have to ask, do you feel like the judges themselves are discriminating against these cases? Because it almost sounds that way.
It's hard to, I think everyone in the federal judiciary probably tries to do a very good job. I think that they think over time that they have had all these doctrines and inferences that they're told to apply. Now, of course, someone's creating them, right? Some set of judges are creating them. And if they would like, they could, in fact, some of these judges could, in fact, kind of fight against this system. But as I said, you know, there's a lot of these cases are being even reversed after jury verdicts. So it's, you don't want to be the person who's going to be reversed. So I think that they think that they can make a judgment as to whether or not discrimination has occurred. And I think that that is a is incorrect. And I think in order to change this, which was, I think, part of also your question, I think we're trying to, by talking about this and by writing the book, trying to inform people about what is going on. And we definitely need some an amendment to some of the statutes to say that you can't use these doctrines and inferences, and also something to the effect of that we should liberally construe this language in the statutes that is right now. It's quite broad.
Do you have any hope that that may happen, especially as we've been having so many conversations about this?
I think it's going to be take some time. I don't think that we're in the political climate where Congress will be taking action about this, because the context in which sexual harassment is coming up is in a context that doesn't involve the courts. I don't think that they're going to have their focus on the courts. So I think people like me and other academics and other people who are lawyers who are working in this area need to continue to talk about this and need to reach out to people in the legislature to try to make change.
Sujah Thomas is an employment law scholar. She teaches at the University of Illinois Law School. She's the co-author of Unequal, How America's Courts Undermine Discrimination Law. There's a piece that Sujah just wrote, actually, in the San Francisco Chronicle that we will tweet out so everyone can see it, read a little bit more about this. Sujah, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. What you're about to hear is disturbing. It's the story of a tragic murder that rocked Bloomington almost a decade ago. On June 16, 1998, the body of 3-year-old Christina McNeil was found by her father, Barton McNeil, in his Bloomington apartment. Here's the audio of McNeil's frantic call to 911 after he found her.
911, what's your emergency?
I need an ambulance.
Barton McNeil was eventually convicted of killing 3-year-old Christina, although he has long maintained his innocence, and there are several questions that remain about this case. The gut-wrenching incident has been the focus of the podcast Suspect Conviction's second season, which debuted last month. Veteran investigative journalist Scott Reeder is the force behind Suspect Convictions. It's a joint reporting project with one of our partner stations, WGLT. He's on the line now from Springfield to tell us more about not just the true crime podcast, but the tragic Bloomington murder that happened nearly two decades ago. Hi, Scott. Welcome to the 21st.
Hey, it's great to be here.
Thanks for joining me. You know, Scott, there's been already two episodes of this season two. Episode three comes out on Friday. We heard a little bit of the beginning of this story of what happened on June 16th, 1998. I wonder if lots of folks remember this case.
I believe so. It was a fairly high-profile case. I mean, Bloomington in the 1990s would average maybe one or two murders a year. I mean, it was very uncommon. And for a 3-year-old child to die was markedly uncommon.
And where is Barton McNeil today?
He is locked up at Menard Correctional Center in Chester, Illinois. I visited him down at that facility. It's a pretty scary place.
Yeah, I imagine it would be. Why did you decide to pick this case for your second season?
Well, I did, you know, several reasons. One, my first season I did a case out of the Quad Cities, which is about 3 hours from Springfield, and it was a long haul up there every week to investigate and record and do all that. So I wanted something closer to home, central Illinois. We looked at a number of different cases, and this one just fascinated me because from day one, Barton said, I didn't do this. Somebody broke into the house and suffocated my daughter, and I think it was my girlfriend who I broke up with yesterday because she has a history of violence. I think this is the person who did this. And what we know is that the police were very dismissive of this assertion. What we know, though, is that about 10 years later, the girlfriend had married somebody, and her husband had filed for divorce, and she responded by luring his mother to Bloomington from the Chicago area. She met her in a parking lot, struck her twice with a heavy object, strangled her, dragged her into a sewing shop she owned, and broke her mother-in-law's back and boxed her up into a plastic tub and drove her 90 miles away and buried her. So you see somebody here whose response to having a relationship end is to strike back by killing the person her husband, in this case, loved the most. Well, of course, who did Bart love the most? It was Christina. And people were asking, you know, hey, wait a minute here. Maybe she was the person who did this.
And to give us a little bit more background, she was actually convicted of that crime of killing her mother-in-law, correct?
Yes, she is serving a 55-year sentence at the prison in Lincoln, Illinois.
And how long is Barton McNeil's sentence?
He was initially sentenced to 150 years in prison.
Oh, my. Okay. So let's go back and unravel some of this a little bit. And can I ask you, Scott, we're speaking with Scott Reeder, and we're talking to him about his the second season of his podcast, Suspect Convictions. How long did it take you to put this together?
That's a good question. I would say, I guess I would say 4 or 5 months to put this season together. And of course, we're still putting it together because we're learning new things real time and producing a new episode each week, and new developments come to light, and we add those in. So you're looking at not something that's just in the can and getting released one every week. You're looking at something that's getting produced each week new. And so there's a little bit of, I guess, immediacy to it. I mean, you feel the tension when Willis and I talk back and forth about the case as we investigate it, and you can feel this is real time. This is something that's not a hypothetical or just a story we're telling. It's something that's real lives are involved.
Right, and in the tradition of other true crime podcasts, I'm thinking in particular of Serial, but of course there's Making a Murder. You mentioned Willis. That's WGLT News Director Emeritus Willis Kern, who's also a producer on this with you. So this is an old story, but there's new reporting. I wonder, when you initially thought about doing the case, was this something where, did Barton McNeil reach out to you, or did you reach out to him?
I reached out to him. I dug through a lot of different cases, talked to different defense attorneys, looking for cases that were particularly interesting, or where there was a pretty strong case for innocence that could be made, and I just found this case absolutely fascinating. Keep in mind that, we've heard his voice on the 911 tape, and my reaction when I listened to that is, can that be the voice of the killer? I mean, that did not sound like somebody who had just done something horrible and then was calling 911. That struck me as just a grief-overwhelmed father, you know, like, what can I do here? And, you know, He was initially deemed by the police and the coroner, investigators at the scene, to be a natural causes death. He went back to the house later that afternoon, and he went into the bedroom where his daughter slept, and he found cuts in the screen right above the levers, and you could take a screen out of the window. And he said, wait a minute, somebody has broken into this house. Something's wrong here. So he kept repeatedly calling 911, trying to get a homicide detective to come back out there and take a look at what was on that scene. And,
right.
You know,
we actually have part of those calls. So let's hear some of that.
I have reason to believe now that I am convinced that she was murdered, and I need a detective here immediately.
Okay.
I don't know if they saw this or not, but I just discovered it myself.
Okay. Now, is that a house or an apartment?
An apartment house. I'll be waiting outside. It's 1106 apartment number 2, North Evans. Please,
sorry. 1106 North Evans?
Yes.
Okay, I thought you said North Prairie.
I probably did. It's
North Evans. 1106 North Evans, apartment number 2.
Yes.
Okay, I'll get him out for you.
Thank you.
Bye. Let me just say, did you find a child dead this morning? On North Evans?
I did, you say?
Yeah, I'm asking. I had a guy call up and said that he found his daughter dead this morning.
His daughter dead?
At 1106 North Evans, apartment number 2.
Yeah.
And he said that the detective's been out there, the coroner's been out there, but he is now convinced that it was a murder. He's found evidence there. He wants a homicide detective immediately.
Well,
I don't know what detectives are working tonight.
Well, two of them went to Iowa. McKinley's up there. You want to have him call back to talk to McKinley?
That's part of the Suspect Convictions podcast. It's a second season. It's the true crime story of the case of Barton McNeil and his 3-year-old daughter, Christina, who died. Barton McNeil is currently in jail, serving a 150-year sentence for her death. We're talking to Scott Reeder, the veteran journalist behind this podcast that looks deeper into the story. Scott, so as you were saying, Barton McNeil later that day called 911 back. He repeatedly asked for the Bloomington police to come to send a homicide detective back to his apartment. You said he had seen, maybe it looked like part of the part of the window had been cut open. What did the detective say? What did the detective say when they got there?
Well, I think it's more interesting what they said before they got there. When he called back, like the third or fourth time, the dispatcher calls up the lieutenant back in the detective bureau and says, "This guy keeps calling, and he says his daughter's been killed." And can you? And the detective, the lieutenant's response is, "What the hell is his problem?" You know, it's like, "What do you mean? What the hell is his problem?" His daughter's been killed. I mean, that day. I mean, you know, just kind of a almost indifference that you saw on the side of law enforcement there in this particular case. But eventually they sent somebody out, and they looked at the scene, and Bart says, "I think that my former girlfriend, who I broke up with last night, cut the screen, unlocked the screen, and climbed in and suffocated my daughter." And they were kind of dismissive. I mean, his girlfriend was a very petite, very pretty Asian woman. She's not what stereotypically people would think of as being a killer. And the next day, when they had the autopsy done, they found that she had indeed been suffocated. So the police's response was to arrest Bart because he was the first person to say that she'd been suffocated, and and the thought was, well, how would he have known if she'd been suffocated unless he was the one that did it? Well, you know, I think if you find your daughter face down on a mattress with a bloody nose, it doesn't take a lot to figure out that maybe that's what happened. But that's neither here nor there. It's just a fascinating. Within 24 hours, they focused in on the father.
Right. I imagine all of this must have come out during the trial, right? Because I imagine this is what Barton McNeil's attorneys must have said during this trial. What was the police response during the trial, and what have the police said since?
Well, I mean, they just said, well, he was home alone with his daughter. She was killed. Who else could have done this? They were very dismissive of any evidence that Somebody would have come in through the window to do this. They thought it was way too far-fetched that that could happen. It struck them as, you know, it would take a real diabolical schemer to get something like this accomplished, you know, break in, suffocate a child, slip back out, put the screen back in, and they just did not believe that. And he had a bench trial. The defense tried to present a case that there was an alternate suspect, but the judge would not allow that to be presented, saying they didn't have enough evidence to point to Masuk Nolan, his girlfriend, as the alternate suspect. So essentially, about the only thing, well, not the only thing, the only thing that they presented as far as the defense is Barton McNeil testifying on his own behalf. There was no expert witnesses. There was no rebuttal testimony. They were denied the opportunity to present an alternate scenario where the girlfriend had done it, and he was found guilty.
Scott, season one of Suspect Conviction shined a light on an Iowa murder that you were pretty close to when you were in the Quad Cities. You've had a long career as a journalist with stops in Texas and Vegas and Iowa. I wonder, do you believe Barton McNeil? Do you think that he didn't murder his daughter?
You know, I've been a reporter for a really, really long time, 30 years. I've interviewed a lot of criminals over those years. Heck, I covered the Illinois State House for 19. Some of those criminals worked in the building, but I find him, when I talk to him, I find him extremely credible. I mean, I don't get a sense of somebody lying. Now, people can fool you. I mean, I'm not naive. I mean, but he's very well spoken. He's very bright. He makes his case very calmly. This is what happened. You know, he's got some credibility in my eyes.
And I mean, as we think about this, I wonder if you can give us a sense at all. So we've had two, as you said, this is kind of a story that it's being played out now. You're still reporting it out. Can you give us a sense of what's coming up next?
Sure. The Illinois Innocence Project has become involved in this case. I'm told that they're going to be filing some motions on his behalf to try to get him a new trial, or, you know, at least a post-conviction hearing to try to get him a new trial in the coming weeks. I think we're going to see some new developments happening. And of course, when you have those type of cases, you have more evidence being presented. There's a lot of things that I think are going to be coming up. You know, folks who are interested in this case can find it on iTunes, or they can just go to suspectconvictions.com and subscribe to it. I think it's something that, you know, if you're from Illinois, this is something that's going to be a really interesting case. It also says a lot about not only a tragedy, but how government sometimes works when it interacts with people. And sometimes it works well, and sometimes it doesn't work very well at all.
That's Scott Reeder. He's the owner and producer of the podcast Suspect Convictions. As he mentioned, for those of you who are in the Bloomington-Normal area, you can actually hear installments of this every Friday on WGLT Sound Ideas at noon and again at 6 p.m. And for everyone else, as he said, available at their website or wherever you get your podcasts. We'll tweet out the link to that. Again, it's Scott Reeder telling us about this case from 1998. Lots of new information that seems to be coming out. The case of Barton and Christina McNeil. Scott Reeder, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
It's great to be here.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. As we're coming up on the season of giving, of course, everyone likes to think that our gifts and donations are going to the right place. Well, in the case of the Rockford charity Vietnow, that has not been the case. It's just been revealed that at least 80% of the $15 million in donations raised by the Rockford charity were being capped by for-profit telemarketers or were being used for administrative costs. The funds were intended to help veterans with joblessness and post-traumatic stress, but after all of this level of fraud was unearthed, thanks in part to a Chicago Tribune investigation, Attorney General Lisa Madigan has just announced a settlement led by Illinois and 23 other states to dissolve the charity. The Attorney General is with me now to talk about that investigation and subsequent lawsuit. Attorney General, welcome back to The 21st.
Thanks for having me, Nyla.
Of course, tomorrow is Veterans Day, and we think about the fact that we know Americans as a country are very generous about where we like to donate money. Can I just ask you about this case of Vietnow first? They were supposed to be supporting military veterans. What did you discover about what they were doing with their funds instead?
Well, what I have learned over a series of cases over the years is that instead of the majority of money being used to go to veterans and helping support them, the vast majority of money, nearly 90% of it, in fact, was being retained by the professional fundraisers, as opposed to going to needed services for veterans.
And what were the details of the settlement that you announced this week then?
The details of the settlement are that the board members of Vietnow have agreed to no longer participate with Vietnow. In addition, the controlling officers are not going to be involved with any charity in the state of Illinois at this point. So they won't be doing any future fundraising, charity management, or oversight of any charitable assets. What's going to happen is a receiver will be appointed to determine what assets there are left with Vietnow, and those assets will be distributed to two national charities that we know are doing good work on behalf of veterans.
Attorney General, in the Chicago Tribune, one of those controlling officers, Joseph Lewis, said that, quote, he was heartbroken and that there was, quote, no malice on anyone's part. I wonder what your response is to that and what you think we need to know as citizens who are donating to different causes to help particularly veterans, but everyone.
Well, unfortunately, this issue of Vietnow and the professional fundraiser that they've engaged isn't recent. It goes all the way back, in my knowledge, to at least 2002, which was one of our first cases against the professional fundraisers that Vietnow was using. And then we had another case in 2007, and then our last case was in started in 2016. And so we've seen an unfortunate history of really egregious fraud with this charity. And I think that the message for the public is you really have to know what your money is going toward. And so if somebody calls you, and we see this particularly when people are raising money allegedly on behalf of veterans, active duty service members, police officers, firefighters, it's very compelling. People want to be generous. But unfortunately, we also see an awful lot of scam artists operating in this space. And so I always say to people, you need to do a little bit of homework before you make a charitable contribution. You can do that by getting on the internet. There are a number of different resources, GuideStar and others, that do some work to rate organizations. You can call our office, the Illinois Attorney General's office. We oversee over 35,000 charities as well as fundraisers, professional fundraisers in Illinois. Do a little bit of homework. Don't just be, you know, led by your emotions where you want to help and writing a check. You know, a $5 check, a $50 check, a $100, $500 check, you think you're doing good work, but in fact, it adds up to millions of dollars that people are just keeping and are not using for the purposes that you intended.
Attorney General Lisa Madigan, before we go, I don't think I've spoken to you since you've announced you won't be seeking re-election. And I just want to ask you, there's up to 8 candidates now vying for your position. Did you know that you apparently have one of the best jobs in the state? And how many
people? I do. I totally agree. I do have among the best jobs in state government. I mean, it's always wonderful to be able to be an advocate for people, and obviously because of the number of people that are running, there are a lot of other people that would like that opportunity. So I wish them all well, and it's going to be an interesting race.
Are you going to wish anyone in particular well? Is there anyone you're going to be endorsing?
On the Democratic side, I know and like all the candidates, so you know, I've spoken to all of them, and I think it's going to be a great race to watch.
That's Attorney General Lisa Madigan reminding us with some important information, especially ahead of Veterans Day. Attorney General, thanks for your time.
It's my pleasure to talk to you.
These days, Chicago sports fans don't have a lot to celebrate between the Bears and the Cubs. It's been kind of a depressing fall, but we've got one team that may be lesser known but should give us all a reason to celebrate. I'm not even going to mention the Chicago Bulls because they're even more depressing. Let's put it that way. Last month, the Whitney Young High School Dolphins girls tennis team became the first Chicago public school team to win a state girls title in the sport, and making it even more of a historic victory, their team made up primarily of young women of color, and their coach was the first African-American to win Coach of the Year. We've got Coach Dempsey Willard and two of the team members here with me in studio in Chicago. Cameron Salter and Madison Beckham are also here. Congratulations, guys. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having us.
So, Coach, let me start with you and ask, what did you do to get this team to win a first state title in tennis?
Well, I think the most important thing that I did is try to make sure that whatever they needed necessary for them to do to be the best tennis player, I made sure that I had that information or tactics ready for them.
Cameron, you're a senior. Both you and Madison are seniors. What's it like to compete at this level? Is it nerve-wracking?
So this is my fourth year going downstate, but each year you still have that same anxious feeling in your stomach. You don't sleep during the whole tournament, but I just try to get a good positive head on my shoulders.
Madison, what about you? Was this also your fourth year then?
Yes, it is my fourth year. For me, it wasn't that nerve-wracking. I'm used to playing in tournaments, but it was definitely special this time.
This is the first Chicago Public High School to win a tennis state championship since 1944, when Senn High School and Bobby Everts won the championship. Congratulations to the Dolphins of Whitney Young High School, your 2017 state champions.
Did you guys go in with the goal of winning? Oh, you're shaking your head. You're saying no.
Go ahead, Cameron. For the best, that's always a possibility, but we just try to do the best we can. We never thought, let's go down and win this as a team. You know what I mean?
Coach, what did you say to them on that front?
We had a meeting before we left.
What did you say?
I stated to them that I had received some new information from an online tennis product, and I said this is going to be our secret weapon for this tournament. And I stated that if we win the state tournament, that I will retire.
Are you kidding?
That's what I
said. So now are you retiring?
No, I'm not retiring.
Oh, no.
No, I'm not.
Let me ask, Cameron, most people, Whitney Young, for people outside of Chicago who don't know, Whitney Young is one of the best public high schools in the city, in the state. Did you pick Whitney Young with the idea of how great it was academically or because you wanted to play tennis?
Well, I got to Whitney Young in seventh grade. There was a seventh and eighth grade program, and I knew from the start that's where I wanted to go to school. The girls I used to play club tennis with all went to Whitney Young. They were the best in the city, and I just had to go there because that's where you went when you wanted to play tennis and wanted to go far.
Madison, how about you? How long have you been playing tennis?
I've been playing tennis since I was about 8 years old.
Right. Yeah. And did you want to go to Whitney Young for the tennis or for... Yes.
Definitely both.
Okay.
Because they're known for like their academic excellence and everything. It's like our motto. But definitely the tennis team too. All my older friends that are like graduated now, they all played on the team and did all this great stuff. So I definitely want to be a part of that.
So it's interesting to talk about a tennis team because it's really an individual sport unless you're playing doubles. Coach, what kind of things do you teach your players in a team setting?
The most important factor that I expressed to the girls is that it was all about team. I was always aware that a lot of the girls play USTA tournaments and they primarily did things on their own, but they knew once they became a member of the Whitney Young's tennis team that they had to act as a team.
Cameron, how did Coach do that?
Yeah, tennis is a very isolated sport, especially playing singles. It's very mentally exhausting. You're by yourself. You got to deal with this stuff by yourself. So coming in as a freshman, this whole team thing was so new to me. Luckily, I've been playing with my teammates since way before high school, so I've already known that we already have this very strong bond, but learning how to play as a team is very different. So Coach is very adamant on, you know, team bonding and working together.
What kind of things did you guys do to bond?
We do a lot of like fun stuff after practice, sleepovers or movies, going to lunch or dessert, going to dessert place a lot.
Yeah, and just hang out with each other, yeah. Right? And which is very different than the whole idea of tennis. So I have to ask you guys, I'm a huge tennis fan. Let me start with asking you, Madison, Venus or Serena? Who is your favorite? Oh, can I even ask
Serena.
You to pick? No question.
Serena, definitely.
Cameron, you're saying the same thing.
Yeah,
Serena. Okay, and what about role models for you all? I mean, I think when we think about women's tennis, I mean, Serena Williams is certainly up there with greatest athletes of all time, let alone forget about just for tennis. Do you guys feel like, I don't know who inspired you all to start playing tennis? I think it's amazing how many African-American women are in the sport now. Was that an important thing for you, Cameron?
Yeah, that was a definitely important thing for me, watching TV and seeing, oh, she looks like me and she's winning. And that's a lot of motivation. I also like Lena. She was this Asian tennis player. She retired, but she was just so composed, and that's how I try to model my game after, because sometimes you get frustrated, you can be demonstrative and all this, but Lena was always under herself, and she just had a short memory, so if she made a mistake, next point was fresh, and that's what I try to model my game after.
Yeah. Madison, what about you? Who are your role models in the sport?
Definitely Nadal, I'd have to say. He's such a grinder, and he's the best, but he acts like he works like he's not. Like, he always works like he's the second best, the third. And
especially in the past couple of years, right?
Because
he's been around for a long time now. He's really got a push to have his game against all of these younger players. Cameron, are you your senior? Where are you thinking about going to college, and are you thinking about playing tennis?
Well, as of now, my number one is Spelman College in Atlanta. My mom went to Spelman. My dad went to Morehouse. So my whole family is this big HBCU family. I love Spelman, but they don't have a tennis team, unfortunately. But I want to start something like this new thing to intramural tennis where it's intense and it has the same drive as, say, a D3, D2 school.
Madison, how about you?
My choice was Howard. But I also want to go to an art school. I want to be actually a journalist, actually.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but a video journalist.
So for you guys, tennis is something that you will not necessarily pursue in colleges. No one's thinking professional tennis careers here, either of you. You're both going, no. Why is that?
I love tennis. I do. But I have other passions. And I think that tennis has given me open so many doors for all the things that I want to do. I love it, but it's not something that I want to do for a full-time job.
Yeah. What has tennis taught you about everything else?
For me, tennis has strengthened my game mentally. Like, in school, I'm able to manage my time. I'm able to work on this thing for a longer period of time just because how focused I'm able to be.
Yeah, it's really hard, right? Because when you're playing tennis, if you're down like two sets and you're just thinking, maybe is this over? I've got to keep playing and I've got to keep going through this. It's a lot of mental toughness that you've got to learn, right? Madison, what about you?
Definitely. What you just said, actually, because when you're out there in like 103 degrees and you're down like 3-2 in the second set, like, you go crazy. Mm-hmm. And it's like in school, you have to you can't give up. You got to keep going. You got to keep grinding and that brings me back to why I love Nadal and all that stuff. So that's definitely just taught me to just keep grinding and keep going.
That is Whitney Young Sr., Madison Beckham. I want to thank also Cameron Salter for being here and their coach, Dempsey Willard. They are the state champs in tennis. First Chicago Public School team to win the title. Ladies, coach, thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
Thank you so much
for having us.
We're out of time for today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. If you have Alexa, we're easy to find. Tell her, ask NPR One to play The 21st. All of those links, directions for Alexa, and every other way to contact us. If you want to send us an email, if you'd like to leave us a voicemail, if you'd like to figure out all of our social media handles, you can just remember our website. That's 21stshow.org. Speaking of social media, if you follow us on Twitter, our handle is 21stshow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. When we're not on air, you can follow us for the latest in Illinois news. I'm Nyla Boudou. We're broadcasting today from the Medill Graduate School of Journalism in downtown Chicago. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.